and welcome to the Nikonian's Behind the Lens podcast interview series. I'm Jason Odell, and today I'm in Los Angeles, California, and I've had the privilege to join Nikon legend Vincent Versace in his studio, and we've spent the day making prints and having a good old time, and Vincent has agreed to sit down with me for a few minutes and give us some time to bring his thoughts to the Nikonians community. Thanks for joining me.
I didn't agree to this. You just basically twisted my arm off my shoulder, so I have no choice. So, yes.
You got to do what you got to do.
That's what you got.
Brute force sometimes works. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today, Vincent.
Oh, no worries.
And, let me set the stage here. We're in Vincent's toy room. It's awesome. And we're surrounded by the largest collection of Matchbox cars I have ever seen, and every one of these things is in their original Matchbox.
Yep.
Which is great. And then the fact that you have an original tricorder and communicator from Star Trek.
And Hypospray.
Pretty much that's it. I'm sold. Forget talking about, we don't need to talk about photography today. The toys are way cooler.
We'll just go take the spaceships around and fly them around the studio.
Exactly. I think when we're done with this, we can go have a battle or something.
Well, here's one thing. Okay. People who collect toys that don't play with their toys are weird.
Good answer.
I play with all of my toys, just so you know, including.
There's your lightsaber. That's better than mine. That's great. Well, speaking of toys, we're going to talk about cameras, and we're going to talk about digital, and we're going to talk about what you've been up to lately. I'll start off with the obligatory stuff. You know, we always have to get these out of the way. What got you started in photography? Why did you say, that's what I want to do?
It was a series of events that occurred when I was about 7 years old. I got into two things at the same time. I got into acting and into photography starting at the age of 7. I sold my first print when I was 9, which was a picture to the local newspaper for $50, and all of a sudden I'm thinking,
that's a pretty powerful drug.
Oh yeah, $50, man. Add 4 zeros to that when you're 9 years old, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took my old man out to a lunch where we had not one but two Frankfurters each with the Frankfurter bun, right? Order of fries, order of onion rings, and two chocolate shakes, and
that was great.
Yeah, but that $50 lasted like 10 years because I was always like, Dad, I got that $50, right? No, I was in the dark room. My uncle was a wedding photographer. I have two uncles that are photographers. One was a wedding photographer and one was a nature landscape photographer. And my wedding photographer uncle took me in, turned the safe light on, put the negative in, did the dark room, you know, hand and dodge and burn dance, and then he put the paper in the developer. I watched the image materialize, and then I got a whiff of Fixer, and it was a done deal. I was absolutely, totally hooked on the whole thing. And I bought my first camera in a yard sale, and it was a rangefinder Nikon, which I wish I had today.
Yeah, I'm guessing the value would be a little higher than what you paid for it.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So you've been a Nikon user then from the very beginning.
I have
essentially
always shot Nikon.
And other than that being what you had, is there anything in particular that you know, what keeps you with Nikon? Everyone always says, well, you know, there's a million camera brands out there. Why are you shooting Nikon?
There are a couple of things. First, it's the quality of the glass. Nikon glass is arguably the sharpest glass in the world. And it's completely color corrected so that because of the multi-coating, no matter how you change the lens, the glass will always be exactly the same. It's why with the first 3 Star Wars movies, all of the special effects that John Dykstra shot with, and even the movie and the TV series, the original Battlestar Galactica, using the Dykstra Flex camera, were shot using off-the-shelf Nikkor glass. And the reason why that was to do all those effects optically, you have to change multiple lenses from wide to telephoto to macro. Mm-hmm. And he could do that with absolutely no color shift. And the color is neutral on a Nikon lens. So that means that I can determine if it's what direction of warmth or coolness or what level of saturation, that the multi-coating does not affect the way the image looks. Also, it's something that I just think is brilliant, a brilliant commitment on Nikon's part, which no other camera manufacturer can say, is that the lens you bought in 1962 fits on the camera body that you bought today and will work at the same level it did when you bought that lens. So their commitment is always for backwards compatibility. They will never abandon their photographer, and that is built into their design business model. And they've been around, you know, since World War II. They were building bomb sites. So you got a company, you got a company that's just been around longer than any other company that's in imaging besides a camera manufacturer. I mean, all of the companies that make software have not been around as long as Nikon's company. So their track record for commitment to backwards compatibility is like, why would anybody question that? So there's that. The ergonomics of the camera, and part of it is because I participate in the ergonomics of the camera. What I know about Nikon's philosophy of design is that they put photographers in the test pilot seat, and it's not engineers that necessarily dictate the design. It is photographers that dictate how the cameras are set up. For example, I was working with another manufacturer's camera yesterday. I wasn't, but I was on a shoot where we were shooting some stills for a pilot I'm working on, where I was being shot and the PC sync was on the downward side of the camera. So when you're holding the camera to shoot, the PC sync kept coming out because it was on the side. Mm-hmm. All right. Nikon doesn't do that. The PC sync's in the front so that you can put it over your neck so that it never comes out. It's little attentions to photographic detail, like where the thumb control is for focus and how that works and why that does that and how you can move focus around. Where things are, the control for focus, the way the sweep of the back of the camera is designed so that your one thumb, your right thumb, can move all the way back and down and control the entire camera while you're shooting. So when you're in the hairball shooting pictures, you're not having to stop, look at it, think, and put it there. You can train yourself so that you can move and all the things are positioned so that they fit the average hand.
Excellent. I mean, those are stuff that you know it's good when you're not thinking about it.
Right.
And I never thought about it, but you're right. It's all just right there.
Well, yes. I mean, like right down to like highlight warnings. I remember when that first was put in, that was a conversation about what would you like to see. And one of the things that I argued to have in the Coolpix 990, which is, I believe, the first time that actually was showed up, was in video, they have something called zebraing, which means that when you're blowing out your highlights, it zebras across the screen and tells you, well, isn't that important to know? And yes, you can do that. So why not do that?
The technology was there.
Yeah, it's like it's no thing to put it in. So putting it in.
And I guess you've had a hand in a lot of these little features that our listeners probably don't know about but use all the time. Like one thing we talked about earlier was the in-camera sharpening settings.
The camera, it's the camera sharpening settings for Nikon capture, which are the same, I guess, in-camera sharpening settings, or the sharpening settings that are in camera. Yeah, that had to do with in version 2 of capture.
Way back when.
Having a bunch of camera designers and code writers from Japan sitting in my studio for a bit, which was a very uncomfortable experience because they, you know, everybody's hovering around you and you're doing something, and then they ask you why you're doing that, and then you explain it to them. It's like, oh, okay. And then, so yeah, and it's like, so, and just knowing how the stuff evolved is always kind of cool.
That's really neat. Now, so what's your primary camera these days?
So
I see you got a lot of them around here.
Yeah, I have an arsenal of them. The principal camera, the workhorse camera, is a Nikon D2XS. I have a D200. Also have a D200 balanced for enhanced infrared, and then two D70s, one balanced for standard infrared, one balanced for deep black infrared, and then a point and shoot that I don't remember the number of, but
but it's there.
It's there. And I use the point and shoot for stealth photography, which is, I whip out a D2XS, what do you know about me? But if I pull out a little point and shoot camera, then I'm just, you know, the average Joe taking a picture. But the beauty of digital is that you can produce you know, world class images out of something that small.
So speaking of digital, I assume you shoot RAW.
Is there another file format?
Well,
there's another.
There is, but now you're shooting. I mean, as compared to JPEG, I mean, but
Satan's file format. No, I don't use JPEG. I shoot 100% RAW.
Okay, and so in your workflow, I noticed that you keep the you pretty much use the NEF format all the time.
Completely, yes.
Completely, and what are the advantages that you see with that format?
Well, it's the file format of the camera. It is 100% non-destructive. I can't figure out how something can be non-destructive if you're changing from one file format to another. All the data that was ever recorded will be there. You never have to worry about the lookup tables never being included in Capture NX or any iteration of where Capture is, because it just, I mean, the amount of code that a lookup table is so tiny that there was that one instance where another camera manufacturer did not include a, and I'm actually going to go to defense to the competition. And all that was it was just an oversight. It didn't get included. It wasn't that. It was a conscious decision not right. to. And they corrected it so quickly. I can't see why any camera manufacturer wouldn't want to do that. I choose to use NEF files because that's, you know, why duplicate something? There is no need. And it's 100% non-destructive file format. And you're never touching the original data. No matter what you do when you're in NX, you're setting it in metadata and an instruction set. But that raw data never, ever, ever gets touched.
Mm-hmm. So you're using Capture NX in your professional workflow.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And now you and I have a little bit in common. You made a DVD, an instructional DVD on Capture NX. Is that correct?
I did.
And
because tell of you, me about you're that. At,
because of me.
I was going to say a nasty word after that. Yeah, actually, I was writing a book, and when I read your book, after not wanting to read your book because I didn't want to get contaminated and I wanted to write my own book, when I got done reading your book, I decided that I wouldn't write a book because I thought your book covered everything I was going
to
cover.
Oh, well, thanks. But then you went ahead and took it to the next level. You made an instructional DVD video.
Well, I looked at what the disconnects were because I teach a lot, right? And I travel a lot and I get in front of a lot of people, and I listen to what the disconnects were with the software, because it's such a change in the way in which you do things. I mean, like even down to the subtleness of, instead of it being black point, midpoint, white point, it's black point, white point, midpoint. And the reason why that was put there was, what is the order in which you do things? So the whole design mm-hmm. of NX was designed on how do you move things quicker? How do you do things efficiently? How do you work in a circle, which was one of the discussions we had in the beta testing part of it. What would you like to see? That's why the UI, you know, say what you will about the visualness of the UI. I'm not going to argue with you with that.
That's okay. They're going to make it better, I'm sure.
Believe me, they're going to make it better. But the functionality of the UI, the way in which it's set up, the backbone of it, I think is fairly brilliant in its simplicity. It's designed to get you out as quickly as possible. And so what I was looking at is that people, when you used Capture before, you didn't quite use it as a creative tool. You opened it, or at least I used to use it as to open up my RAW files, do some low-level tweaking to get it right, then save it as a 16-bit TIFF.
Right.
And then move it into a pixel editor like Photoshop. But with NX, I can stay almost exclusively in the RAW file format and then use Photoshop for what it was designed to do, which was to be an Emery board, not a jackhammer. I mean, you have to keep in mind, Photoshop is one of the most brilliantly conceived pieces of software mm-hmm. ever written. To the point where you have a piece of software that is now treated as a verb, mm-hmm. you know. So you have this brilliant piece of software that was never designed to actually edit, to be a photo editor. It was always designed as a graphic arts tool, but it was so powerful in its creative thought that it could be used to be a photo editor. And for the longest time, was the de facto operating system of photography. So what we kept seeing, or what we saw, what the need was seen, I think, that you need something that brings you back to photography. And things like Lightroom and things like Capture NX and Aputure are those types of answers to that. Now, the softwares that I use are Capture NX and Lightroom. Mm-hmm. All my raw files are handled in Capture NX in the sense of when I'm going to work on them on the raw data state, that's
what you do.
That's what I do. But if I'm going to go look for something and browse and store and stuff like that, mm-hmm. you know, build a slideshow on a web page, yeah, Lightroom's great for that. But if you're a Nikon shooter, there really is only one way to work on a file, a raw file, and that's in NX. You can't beat the U-point technology for aesthetic control. I have one file on the DVD, which the thing you have to keep in mind with the DVD, which I don't think people know, is that all of those images on the second DVD, except for one, that was the first time I did them. You know, it was not like, oh, we'll do this image, that image, that image, and cook it. It was, let's do these images because I want to do these.
So you
images.
Did them in real time as you were.
Right.
Hey, let's pull this
out. There are a couple of times where you actually see me thinking, because I had one guy comment, it's obvious that, you know, he knows Photoshop better than Capture NX. Well, I have, you know, 15 years or so on Photoshop, and
it's been around that long.
Yeah. 1 year. I've worked with Photoshop since version one. But it was just a giggle, like, that you can see me going, what do I want to do here? Okay, let's do that. And I had one file where it's 350 megabytes in Photoshop to produce it, one 16-bit, one 8-bit file, and I did the same thing to it in Capture NX, and it's 8.5 megabytes.
Kind of nice, isn't it?
Kind of extraordinary.
So as a fellow Capture NX user, what are the, you know, if there was two or three things that really set it apart, you know, why should someone think about, everybody has a choice about what software to go. And a lot of people have some experience with Photoshop or Elements or whatever. But if you're thinking about Capture NX, what would be the tipping point? Why should you really consider that as a Nikon shooter? Other than the fact that it's probably, you know, the best NEF conversion engine out there. What else does it do that's so special?
Well, do other camera manufacturer, like the other people who use other cameras, ever listen to the Nikonian website? Do you think?
Unlikely.
Well, then, okay. No matter whose camera you use, first off, you will get a better RAW file from using the camera manufacturer's conversion software, mm-hmm. no matter how kludgy it is. And there are some out there that are like, okay, you know, take all my teeth out with a pair of pliers, no Novocaine. Thanks. Way to use. That said, the best RAW conversions that you're going to get for Nikon files will be from NX because mm-hmm. it understands how the file is cooked, what's going on in the camera. They just have a better understanding. Mm-hmm. It's not a reverse engineered product. Second, and actually primary, U-point technology, control points. Having the ability to control and build, I don't know if they're really masks, but the way in which you can put control point here and another control point here and say, do this, don't do that, and they meet. Okay, to do that with a RAW file and then to be able to save off 17 different types of changes in little instruction sets and never touch the RAW data, that's great. See, because like, I guess what it is for me is it brings you back to photography. And I think a big problem today is that because of the power of digital photography and the power of the creative engine where impossible is simply just an opinion, we are running into becoming image makers instead of photographers. And I think that NX and software like that allow us to get back to photography. That it's not about putting an eye in the middle of your forehead or combining, you know, 47 images to make one image, of which, you know, there are techniques out there, some of which I've participated in their creation and fully accept responsibility. But the beauty of NX is that I'm back to a photographic workflow, that I can stick with one image, that I can be in and out, and I can do it completely non-destructively. That's the real key, is that I'm working with raw data, which is the best data to work on before I cook off the TIFF, that I can change everything on that file pretty much except for ISO and really, really bad exposure. I can undo some problems of bad exposure. I have one infrared shot that I took that inadvertently is 5.5 stops underexposed.
Whoops.
Yeah, it's like, I meant to do that. but when I got done with it, it holds, and it holds up to 20 by 24 off of a D70. But you couldn't do that with film, and you know, you couldn't take an infrared roll of film out to 104 degree temperature to shoot, because you know, out in the middle of a third world country in a horse drawn cart, which is how I got to where that was. So, you know, what do I think about Capture NX? It's great for working on images, specifically raw files. I can't think of any other raw editor that I would choose to use. That's the main reason. It really minimizes my time in Photoshop. Not that there's anything wrong with spending a lot of time in Photoshop, but I make my money out in the field shooting. I don't make my money bending pixels. And I think that NX and Photoshop are the adult video game. And all that money you spent playing Missile Command when you were a kid was just training for what you're doing today. So it's that. And it allows me to get back to photography.
Cool. I had another question for you. You were talking about digital infrared. It sounds like you're really, really high on this stuff.
I am blown away by what you can do with digital infrared.
Now, I never shot film infrared, but there were some serious limitations, like namely the infrared filter. You couldn't see what you were doing.
Oh, I feel so sorry for you.
But you now what you – so you've actually gotten – what you did is you sent off some cameras and you got them actually converted where they take the – IR filter off of the
You can go to my website to links and click on Life Pixel, and it'll take you right there if you're keen on this.
But I'm and your website is what address now?
VersaceFotography.com.
Okay, and I'll put a link to that on our show notes page too. It's good to have that out there.
So digital infrared. The problems with film infrared was that it needed to be refrigerated. That film infrared focused at a different point. Infrared focuses at a different point than visible light, and that you're only basically photographing the infrared frequency. It was highly contrasty, very grainy, sometimes had a bit of a glow, required special filters, and required refrigeration. Okay, so it was very, very limited to how you could use it. Mm-hmm. But when it works, it's just awesome. But, you know, it's such a special dance that in such difficulty to do it, and the cost of processing the film and, you know, doing the oh please dance while you're waiting for the contact sheets and stuff made it not something that a lot of people did. Now, with digital infrared, one of the unique characteristics of a CCD is that a CCD actually captures well into the infrared and has to be clipped. You actually have a filter in the camera that truncates the infrared light. So there are three ways to convert a camera to infrared. There's enhanced color, standard infrared, and deep black. And I just had two cameras converted to enhanced infrared and to deep black, which I'm going to take into Peru, which is my next gig. And I'm going to try them up at Machu Picchu, because I think that having been up there before, what a hoot that is going to be. So if I get big weather and big fog and clouds,
which would be neat.
Yeah, with green trees and black rocks. And so, I mean, it's going to be pretty wild. So I'm going to look at the enhanced color. And what that does is it allows all of the red, green, and blue plus the infrared. The standard infrared allows for green and blue to some degree with a filter in there that allows mostly the infrared. So some of the tricks to it, and the deep black, I did because I wanted to see what it was going to do, so that when I'm working on producing my next DVD, which is, I got a couple of them, one of which I hope to do is going to be every black and white conversion technique known to man. So I'm going to have all those files to look at. But the tricks to it is that still infrared focuses at a different point. What you want to do is try to shoot it around F8, which is generally critical aperture for the lens. Mm-hmm. If you shoot at F8 with the contrast at normal and put the sharpening to high, what will happen is you will negate the slight blur that occurs through the focus shift in infrared.
Okay.
The other thing that you want to do is you want to set your camera to enhanced color and color mode 3, because you want to get as much color data as you can. Why? Because the camera is also capturing aspects of green and blue information. So the more meat you have to that file, the more richness you can get when you finally convert it to black and white.
So you start with this color image, and then in post, you'll convert it to black and white.
Right. It's like no infrared you've ever seen and like no color image you've ever seen. And when you look at it the first time, you're going, what the? I mean, because it's just kind of greenish, bluish, but the skin tone is white sort of thing. And the key to it is how you post-process it, but you treat it as a color image and accept that the color is off. But you want to boost the colors up so that when you convert the image to black and white, you will get the deepest detail and the greatest tonality. Mm-hmm. See, one of the cool things about digital black and white versus film black and white is that you have the variables in addition to just luminance and the collision of red, green, and blue that affect luminance, you have the ability to increase hue, saturation, as well as color in black and white. And by doing that, you can really, really control the depth of your black and white images. I think that, and I know this is a little bit of heresy, and before I say this, I want to preface this with, in my professional career for 15 years as a Hollywood photographer, I shot over 5,000 rolls of black and white film a year. And my entire life was as a black and white photographer, large format. The only reason why I got into color was that two of my corporate sponsors, Nikon and Epson, told me that if I didn't start shooting color and quick, they had no use for me. So I'm a black and white photographer.
Okay.
I can make better black and whites in digital than I can in silver. The difference is that silver has a metallic look, that it's the look of the medium that is what is unique. But the dynamic range is greater in digital than it is in film. And the deepness of the black is greater in digital than it is in film. The best that black and white paper can do, silver paper, is a D-max of 2.2 on its very, very best day with its highest content of silver, selenium tone, and all this other sort of stuff. You can get prints off of inkjets that have a D-max of 2.8. So what do you got going on here? Yeah, on a scale of 1 to 4, 2.8 is significant in comparison to 2.2. Mm-hmm. But you can also get 2.8 with a color print, which you can't get in silver. Trippy. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that cadmium and zinc are not in silver papers. And the silver contents are so reduced that you don't get pure blacks like you do. The prints we fell in love with, you can't make. Because the paper doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So with regards to all of this, with digital infrared, there's no grain, there's no halos. You can shoot it in 107 degrees. And when you look through the viewfinder, you're actually seeing the scene because the filter is internal. It's not over the glass.
Right, right. That was one of the drawbacks.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, I've got a Harris filter that's great for shooting infrared, but it's so opaque that you don't know what you're shooting until after it's done and the film's developed, and it's like, great.
Hope for the best.
Yeah.
Well, that's really interesting. And so if people want to get more information about how to convert their camera to infrared, they can go to your website and click on the...
Well, how to convert it, yeah. Just go to the links page, and there's a link to it on my page. That's just the easiest way. In the DVD, I have one of the chapters is on how to do it. And what I do with all my DVDs is they're all live fire. You actually get actual raw files to work on or actual 16-bit full-res TIFFs, because I believe that it is important to feel the pain when you do this. Otherwise, mm-hmm. It's a literary event. Yeah, I can hand you a 72 DPI file, but the problem with that is you can't see how sharpening works. Because sharpening works differently, let's say, than on a smaller file than it is in a big file.
Right.
And things take longer. So yes, I can give you the appearance of how fast it works. But what I think is important is to be able to see how slow things work and fast things work, because that will teach you the hard way about what workflow really is about, which is, you know, efficiency of how you do things. I get a kick out of the way people like, you know, I'm going to teach you workflow. Like, well, there is no 17 steps to perfection. All images are different, and no two images are the same, so all workflow should be dynamic. If you think that there is a, you know, checklist for success, one of the problems with that is, you know, you fall into Einstein's definition of lunacy, which is doing the same thing over and over, expecting the result to change. So, you know, you've got to be willing to say, you do it this way all the time, except when it doesn't work. And when that doesn't work, then you do this, except when it does and doesn't work. And you have to look at how to make your workflow efficient. You have to be dynamic about it.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking about dynamic and rules, we had a great conversation today earlier about the rules of composition.
Oh, God.
And you definitely had some opinions on it. And because we're looking around the room here, and there's some wonderful photographs hanging here in your studio, and a lot of these appear to break all the rules.
Yeah, they do.
They're all really good.
Well, thanks. I mean, it makes my day. You know, it's like what composition rules are when you get into all of that. It's a bunch of people trying to describe what somebody was doing organically. Like, they look at a cool picture and, well, what makes this cool? Well, look at this, look at that, look at how we use space. And I think that a lot of times when the picture was taken, it was that just looks cool. You know, like the rule of thirds, mm-hmm. or the quadrant rules, or the golden rule, or the center of the picture is for the Lord Buddha, but not for you. You know, don't bullseye. Well, you know, that's great, except when it doesn't work. And there are many, many other elements involved in photograph. There's the geometrics of a photograph. There's shape. There's gesture. There's color. There's time. There's angle. You know, there's light as a solid object. There, you know, patterns, interrupting patterns. How do you play that? How do you force angles to move the eye to where it is? You know, it's like the photograph on the wall I have of the girl. I mean, if you draw a line, in actuality, the main focus of that photograph, the subject, bullseye right in the center of the picture.
Yes, it is.
But if you just look at it because of the way the perspectives and angles are being used, you don't see that it's that. Okay, and if we were to follow that rules, that picture's not successful.
But you look at it, and it's a very nice picture, and there's nothing wrong with it whatsoever.
Right. So
from a composition standpoint.
What those are, like all photographs must have a mid-ground, foreground, background. You know, if you do that, then you're back into Einstein's definition, okay, which is you might as well just buy a cookie cutter. What those are ways to try and express the way the eye sees, or to come up with a way in which to describe what made that particular individual image successful. And, okay, that's like taking apart your watch. And once you've done that, then trying to tell what time it is.
It just doesn't work, does it?
No, it's like they're exercises. You've got to learn the rules appropriately so that you can break them correctly. That's what the Dalai Lama said.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, okay, it's, you know, as an exercise, practice the rule of thirds all day and then let it go. Or practice non-bullseye. Or practice, how do you make a photograph interesting in which the composition, the focal point of the composition is in the center? Who says you can't have the center? I have one photograph where I have three women in black turbans, and they have their heads away from me. So all I see is the black turbans. I got three black circles, and it goes from the top corner to the bottom corner, but horizontal. And then in the center of this photograph is this little girl that's coming the other way. Well, she's dead nuts in the center, but I use the whole frame. So the new rules of composition, I think, are you are responsible for every millimeter of that frame.
That's a good idea.
Use it or not. And this, what I mean by that is if you choose to not fill the frame, that can be every bit as powerful as filling the frame. Because there's a conscious choice. Like, I'm going to use negative space to reinforce positive space. The positive space being, you know, the subject. You can put the object anywhere you want in the frame so long as it looks cool. So the next rule of composition is make it look cool. Well, who decides if it looks cool? Well, you do. Can't you look at something and go, that's cool? Don't you look at pictures that you love and go, wow, that's cool?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know, do you think that the photographer went through all of those changes when they took the picture? Because the most amazing photographs are the ones that capture temporal apogee, timelessness. The moment of you can feel it having moved and about to move, and it's in the process of motion, but it's neither moving or not moving, but it's not stopped. Those are the ones that are the coolest shots. How do you accomplish that? Well, you get out of your own day. You just allow it. I think Ernst Haas said it best, which is, don't take pictures, be taken by your pictures. I don't take pictures anymore. They take me. And the greatest experience I have in photography is being pulled through the lens instead of trying to pull something through the lens, so that it goes the other way, that the subject is so engaging that I'm ripped through the lens in a very pleasurable way. And when I take pictures, I endeavor to not be in them. That there is always the subject and the viewer of my photographs. If the subject's a human being, then obviously there's a person in my photographs. And if somebody's looking at it, it's them. It's sort of like a karate punch. If you hit somebody and you leave your fist in contacted, 95% of the impact is absorbed in the puncher's fist. But if you do, like in karate, which is in and pull out very fast, 95% of the impact is where the fist connected. So make a photograph like that, that you come in and get out, so that the entire impact of the picture is not absorbed by you showing your how wonderful you are by showing me how wonderful this is. How about let me discover how wonderful this is because it was so moving it moved you. And it moved you to fire the shutter. That's what's cool. And that's what makes a photograph take you.
I think that's a great, great concept. I think I'm going to have to spend some time scratching my head and thinking about that myself. And working more on improving my own photography through that concept. Because we all are still learning, right?
I just got done taking a class. I spent all last week taking a class. And I was absolutely... I took a class with Matt Colbert and John Paul Caponegro. And I taught a little bit only because I can't go anyplace without somebody going, hey, dude, can you tell me how to do this? But I got to be a student, you know, most of the time. And I was absolutely in love with that. And if you teach, I think it's important to always make it a point to become a student. And, you know, what's funny for me is that where I used to tell people I was at the beginning of my journey, you know, this is how good I am, this is what I know, I look at where I'm at now and I realize that what it is I used to claim that I know is now where I'm at. And I realize now that where I'm at, where I used to say where I was, I realize that I don't know nothing. There's so much I don't know. And it's with whatever little knowledge I have makes me realize how little knowledge I have and how much I don't know. And it's funny, like at the beginning of every journey, you're convinced that you know everything.
Right.
You know, and when you get to the point where you thought that was knowing everything there was to know, and you hit that like quarter way point on the journey, you realize, Jesus.
The only true knowledge comes from knowing you know nothing, right?
I know nothing.
Well, that is fascinating. Well, that's about all the time we have for today's interview, but I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with our Nikonians audience. And, of course, you can get more information about Vincent's photography at his website, VisaciPhotography.com, if I can say it right. And, of course, there'll be links to all of these wonderful spots on the web where you can learn about his DVD instructional video sets, because you've got more than just the NX, right?
Yeah, six DVDs on that are in each chapter of my book taken out to DVD. My book's called Welcome to Oz.
Okay, and so they can get that. And we'll put the links on our show notes page, which you can find at blog.nikonians.org, and just look for the Behind the Lens series. Well, thank you so much for the time today, Vincent. I really appreciate that.
Well, no worries. Thank you. I got somebody we're going to play Matchbox City now.
Excellent.